Welcome in Amy Rogers from Houston.
Hey there, guys. Well, Nelly Korda met with the media here on site at the Chevron Championship on Tuesday. She seemed refreshed. She seemed rested. She was quite chatty and open about her early success to the season. And I asked her what she felt like she has done well through this early part of the year. And she said it's really been managing her schedule and her body well. In fact, she chose not to play last week in Los Angeles for that very reason. In years past, it's hurt her trying to get here to Houston from LA, and it's cut into her practice time and her ability to be able to make it to that Champions Dinner on Monday. So she chose not to play last week, instead got here early, was able to play Memorial Park, play 18 holes as she's getting to know this golf course for the very first time. And here are some of her first impressions.
Yeah, I saw the weather for the week and I played 18 yesterday. It's definitely a second shot golf course. The greens are pretty tricked out. It just depends on how it's going to play and what play with all this rain that they've gotten. I mean, it can play really long where it's not going to run out. It could play really soft, but it just depends on kind of what we're going to get weather-wise. But from what I've seen, I mean, the par threes are really long. I've had like two hybrids, five irons in. So obviously you're at the end of the tee box because they're trying to preserve the tee box for the tournament. So you don't know where they're going to put it. But par threes are pretty long. Par fives are, some of them are pretty gettable. But overall, I think the defense of this golf course is probably the contours of the green being very sectional.
Did you watch any of the PGA Tour event that was here or talk to any PGA Tour players, get any advice, tips, etc.?
No, I did not talk to any PGA Tour players. I didn't watch too much of the event. We were playing that week, so it was quite hard to watch and also compete. But I know that my caddy, Jason, did. For me, it's hard to kind of, I like to suss out a golf course myself and make my decision myself than relying on someone else's input, because then I have too much information in my mind. And I feel like then if I have their information versus what I scope out on the golf course, I start to doubt my information and then I'm not 100% confident in what I'm doing. So that is kind of why I tend to not always ask for too much information about another golf course, especially from a male to a female, because they have different clubs coming in. Their apex of their ball flight's a lot higher than what ours is. So just from what I was told, though, is that it is kind of like a bomber's paradise. You're trying to hit driver on every hole pretty much, get it as close to the green, because it is very sectional and it's very crucial to have probably shorter clubs in to these greens when it is firm.
Here are a few more details on Memorial Park, which is hosting a major championship for the first time this week. It opened back in 1936 and was renovated in 2019 by Tom Doak with Brooks Koepka as a consultant. The course also hosts the Texas Children's Houston Open on the PGA Tour, which was held just last month. For the women this week, the course will play to a par 72 with a total yardage just over 6,800 yards, which is about 660 yards shorter than it played for the PGA Tour. Now, Korda said when it comes to getting to know a new golf course like Memorial Park this week, she likes to put in a lot of extra time, especially around the greens. She said there's definitely some areas here at Memorial Park where if you don't miss it in the right areas, you won't be able to even get up and down around some of these putting surfaces. She did add that she feels like the par fives are very gettable, where she's hoping she and she'll likely see her fellow competitors rack up a lot of birdies this week. Guys.
Thanks, Amy. Damon, it's interesting to hear Nelly talk about getting there early. And, you know, in past years, on paper, it's not a big drive or a big flight from LA to Houston, but it has proven problematic in the past. Is she taking the kind of the jack approach more recently, the Rory McIlroy approach, and trying to have an uncluttered lead in to a major? Because she was close a couple of times last year, majors. Otherwise, it's kind of a disappointing season. It feels like she's trying to hit a little bit of a reset button in terms of how she goes about the Chevron this year to clean up that process getting there.
It was a disappointing 2025 for her. I like her uncluttered approach to the point where she said she didn't even watch a single shot from the Texas Children's season. It does surprise me, but she explained it beautifully why. Different golf course in terms of the setup. Different clubs that the men are hitting versus the women. She didn't want to have too much information. I like the approach of simplifying it, as she put it. Her season has been borderline spectacular with a win and three runner-up finishes. And I can't help but think about 2024 when she won seven times and the comparisons to potentially having a Caitlin Clark of golf. That never really materialized, her trip to the Met Gala notwithstanding. I just wonder if there is a reboot or a reset and a possibility if she does go on a run that goes beyond second place finishes and gets some more wins under her belt, and in particular, major championships. If the sports world will look at Nelly Korda a little bit differently. I love that she's playing well in Geno, in Hyoju Kim, in Hannah Green, and you know, Charlie Ho won on the LET earlier this year. I love that the best players are playing great and lifting each other up, but I'd love to see Nelly Korda really break through and have a type of year that she had in 2024. And I think her approach this week has been correct.
Well, certainly 2024 was the seminal year of Nelly's career, but in terms of breaking through into a broader sports conversation, well, I guess Nelly has to want that herself as well to some extent. Mm. Nelly has always seemed to be comfortable in drawing the line where she's prepared to let work and her personal life or her private existence kind of meet. And she's always drawn that line pretty clearly. Nelly's not into doing the constant media rounds out there. And no matter how much the LPGA Tour might benefit from that or how much the commissioner might like her to do that a little bit more, I don't necessarily think that Nelly's all that comfortable or all that interested in that. And that's fair enough. And at a certain point, you know, you're a professional athlete, let your clubs do the talking. And should you really have to do some kind of show and tell show on the media circuit after that? Maybe not if you're not that comfortable with it. I mean, Brooks Koepka never did much of that when he was at the top of the golf game. Scottie Scheffler does a lot of it, but Scottie also draws a very clear line where work ends and where home begins.
Well, Nelly Korda is the odds-on favorite to win the Chevron. Someone who knows what it's like to make the jump into Poppy's pond is a two-time Chevron champ, Brittany Lincecum. Bam Bam. Both of her Chevron wins, by the way, came at Mission Hills CC. She won her first major title back in 2009. Do you remember this approach, Eamon? I mean, talk about hitting the right weight, the ball feeding down to this par five, setting up an eagle putt. I mean, just listen to the crowd getting loud, her reaction.
Yeah, she began that final round with a two-shot deficit, and then that eagle putt gave her a one-stroke victory over Christy Kerr. Percy McPherson.
Yeah, and of course, making the leap into Poppy's pond. But then she wasn't done winning majors. It wasn't done winning at Mission Hills. This is 6 years later, 2015.
It wasn't done making eagles on the last hole either.
I mean, it's almost like a carbon copy. You know, using the contours of the green as the ball feeds back closer to the hole. But this time she needs to make an eagle to force a playoff with Stacey Lewis. So 6 years prior is for the win outright. This is just to get into the playoff.
And having started that final round four back, this was for 69. And to go extra holes, that's making a statement right there.
So cool. And then she made a two-putt par on the third extra hole to beat her fellow American star, Stacey Lewis. And great to have Bam Bam with us from the Chevron. Now, I know you've scaled back your playing days, but this is a tournament, Brittany, that you refuse to miss. How would you describe your love and affection for this championship?
Damon, I love you for still calling me Bam Bam. I'm realizing this week that I hit it so much shorter than these girls. I played practice rounds with them, and they are hitting it 20 yards further than me. Obviously, I'm 40. I have two kids. It's a new era for me, but thank you for that. But it is so great to be back. You know, the Chevron Championship, they're doing so many great things to elevate women's golf and keeping old traditions, new traditions alive, and the past champions dinner, the Junior Legacy Pro-Am on Sunday. I actually went to a dinner last night with the AMs that are in the field, so it was great to meet some of them. It's already been a great week, and I haven't even teed it up yet.
We saw you about half a dozen times last year, Brittany, after you'd stepped away from full-time golf at the end of 2024. What does this year hold in terms of the frequency that we might see you out there?
Yeah, I think it's going to be even less. You know, it's just, I just don't have the time to practice with two kids. You know, I play on Fridays with our director of instruction. I love my Fridays, but that's just not enough to get the job done. So I think I'm only going to play maybe two or three this year, just to kind of keep it. You know, once you're a golfer, you're always a golfer. So I can't fully give it up yet, but we're only going to play probably two or three this year.
It's an interesting question, though. How difficult is it to make a clean break and just walk away? Or how long? Do you have a time frame in your mind where you're going to try to, you know, ease yourself into the full-time retirement? Or are you ever going to get there, you think?
I think it's just difficult. You know, I've been out on tour. This might be my 22nd year on tour. So fully shut it down cold turkey, there was no chance I was doing that. You know, speaking to Stacey Lewis this week, she said this will be her last event ever. You know, Allie Ewing, same. Like, I'm not that player that scared me worse than just playing a couple. So you'll see me probably do some guest appearances here and there for the next couple years and just kind of waiting around for the Legends Tour.
Well, you mentioned the past champions dinner, everybody gussied up, bringing out their best outfits, the conversations, the mood. How would you describe the room?
Oh my gosh, it's so fun. You know, I relate more to the legend side. So when you see Pat Bradley, Judy Rankin, Julie Inkster, Pat Hurst, all these players, you know, that I grew up watching play this amazing game, it was so cool to see them get in touch a little bit and just see what they're up to these days. And also get to see some of the young players, you know, Nelly, Lily Avu, and those kind of players. So it's a great mix of everybody, and it's just nice to catch up. And you know, some people traveled, you know, from South Africa, France, or Europe, and they really make the effort to come to the Past Champions Dinner, which is really cool.
We had a couple of past champions on the show earlier in the week with Amy Alcott, Julie Inkster, and it's interesting, Brittany, that they talk about there aren't that many younger players these days who will seek out these veterans and try to soak up the knowledge or experience they have. And on the rare occasion they do, it's kind of an accidental conversation rather than by design. Do you find any of the younger players have tried to seek you out, pick your brains about how to make life work on tour?
Unfortunately, no. I don't know if it's just a different era. You know, when I came on tour, I played my first practice round in Hawaii with Julie Inkster and Pat Hurst, and I picked their brain. I got their phone numbers right away. I talked to them all the time. But nowadays, you know, I don't know if it's just the way college is bringing them up. You kind of already have a team around you. You know, I saw Nelly on the putting green a minute ago, and she probably had six different people around her, whether it's mental coach, you know, trainer, caddy, you know, all these different people. So I don't know if it's just the next generation just doing it a little bit differently, and they, you know, maybe come through the college ranks and that kind of prepares them for the tour and they just don't need the extra help. But I was one that I asked so many questions and, you know, found the answers that way. But yeah, it seems like these players are kind of stick to themselves. You know, nobody really goes to dinner, it seems, together as much anymore. Like back when I played, you know, we always tried to get to dinner or stay in housing together. I thought that was really fun. And everyone's a little bit more on their own, it seems.
Well, speaking of tradition, one thing I loved about the diner was the fact that Poppy's Palm was right there by 18, and the gallery would stand up as players and past champs would walk by, and you would see Poppy's Palm. It was right next to the green, and you knew the history with Amy Alcott. How would you like to see this new pool or the pond in the future worked into this tournament and that tradition kept?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. Again, you know, Chevron doing Chevron things of keeping past traditions alive. And, you know, when I saw the pool the first time on 18, you know, I literally thought it was just going to be an inflatable kiddie pool that we bought from, you know, Walmart. And when I came, and it is a proper pool that they have put in the ground with a pump system with chlorine in it and jets and stairs. You know, they had to have spent a fortune to do that for us, and we can't thank them enough. But 2027, I'm hearing they're building a whole lake or a whole pond for us. I'm not sure if it'll be similar to Palm Springs, where we'll have a little section where you jump into, or if it'll just be one big pond. But I mean, that's pretty incredible to have a sponsor wanting to keep that tradition alive and going to put a lot of money into building that for us for 2027. It's pretty cool.
You've won 8 times out there on the LPGA Tour, Brittany, so you're accustomed to showing up at events with the expectation of contending, competing well and winning. What is it like now for you? Is a good week for you based on performance, or is it based on enjoyment?
Probably more enjoyment. I'm sure the sponsor doesn't like to hear that, but you know, it's just a different time in my life. You know, it's just so great to come back and to go to these dinners and see old friends and to be back inside the ropes. You know, again, like I said, you know, shutting it down cold turkey and not playing any tournaments scared me. So to be able to be in the opportunity to tee it up a couple times a year, I think that's just so great. But you know, I'm going to give it my best. Obviously, like, I am here. I'm going to give it my all, and you know, I'm trying to pick up some more yardage. I already already got a new driver this week. I got maybe 5 extra yards, which is really going to help. We probably got 3 inches of rain over the last couple of days, so the course is really wet, so the ball is not going to go as far. So we're really going to have to rely on those woods and long irons.
You're no different from the rest of us, always chasing those extra yards, mm-hmm. Brittany. Are there any accomplishments you still have out there in golf? I mean, is it a Ryder or a Solheim Cup captaincy in your kind of mind going forward?
I mean, that would be pretty incredible. Just being an assistant a couple years ago was just amazing to be back inside the ropes wearing the red, white, and blue. So if I was honored enough to be an assistant again or to even be a captain one day, I think that would definitely kind of be the top of my, you know, career to top it off. I think the last things to accomplish. But nowadays, you know, I'm running my own charity event for the First Tee of St. Petersburg and just giving back to the kids, the next generation. You know, I love seeing kids involved with the game. And anytime we see kids out here on the golf course, we're always signing those autographs, you know, trying to inspire them to pick up this great game because you can play it through college. You can play until you're 100. It's just a wonderful game. So we want every child to play.
Well, as someone who has played golf with you and been outdriven by you by 30-plus yards, you'll always be Bam Bam to me. Have a great week, and thanks for hopping on with us.
Thank you guys so much.
This week, the PGA Tour is in Avondale, Louisiana for the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. It's the only official team tournament of the PGA Tour's regular season, with two-man tandems competing in foursomes and four-ball play. Last year, Ben Griffin and Andrew Novak teamed up to earn their first PGA Tour victories in this event. Griffin came through in the clutch with this long birdie putt on the 71st hole. That helped secure a slim one-shot victory over the Højgaard twins and kickstarted a heck of a season for Ben Griffin.
Yeah, you're not kidding. For both Ben and Andrew Novak, really kind of propelled them forward. After this win, Ben added 2 more PGA Tour wins, made his Ryder Cup debut, and then played in the Masters. Andrew Novak, 9 top 25s and made his Masters debut. Brently Romine is on site in sunny New Orleans and has more on our defending champions.
Hey guys, yeah, this is an event where we've been spoiled in recent years, right, with Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Xander Schauffele, all part of winning teams. But as last year's defending champions Andrew Novak and Ben Griffin proved, this could also be a launching pad for future PGA Tour stars. Novak has played in 6 major championships in a row since winning here a year ago. And Ben Griffin added 2 more titles, parlaying that also into a Ryder Cup debut back in 2025. And while the attention will certainly be on the defending champs, as well as the Fitzpatrick brothers and Shane Lowry and Brooks Koepka, Novak and Griffin are among those who are well aware that there are future top 10 players in the world and Ryder Cuppers further down this tee sheet.
You may not know some of the names in this tournament yet, but you will. There's some kids playing in this tournament that you better get to learn their names sooner rather than later. And some of them have decided to pair up together, so that's going to be a bit of an issue. But we'll have to deal with that Thursday to Sunday. But yeah, just because you don't know the names yet doesn't mean you won't.
Yeah, the strength of the field is still very strong. Everyone that's on the PGA Tour has a conditional PGA Tour card. They're still incredibly talented golfers. Maybe they just haven't broken through yet. Obviously, the spotlight every single week on tour tends to be kind of the top few names. That's just the nature of how media works. That's what people will kind of want to see, sometimes. But there's so many golfers on the PGA Tour every week. You know, obviously the signature events are a bit smaller at 72 man fields, but you know, most weeks out here at 144 guys. I mean, there's a lot of horses in the race, and everyone that's earned their way into the field has just the same amount of chance of winning as anyone else. It's just a matter of executing the shots and getting over the hump. But yeah, there's tons of guys coming off the Korn Ferry Tour with a ton of talent. Ton of kids out of college that are really strong and good players. And so, just because there might not be like every single guy that's in the top 20 in the world here doesn't mean that like it's going to be a gimme week for a top pair like me and Andrew. Like, it's still very strong. That's the cool thing about the PGA Tour. And yeah, like you said, just because you haven't heard their names, you're probably going to very soon. And everyone has their breakthrough moments. And you know, fortunately for me, I mean, it was here last year. Now look at me now. I was a pick for the player of the year last year, and going into this tournament last year, I wasn't talking to any media. So like, it's cool what things can do, what you can do on the PGA Tour. Every single week can change your career. And, hopefully someone's career isn't changed this week because we win again, but, it happens very often.
Yeah, there are certainly some options on which teams could be the next household names on the PGA Tour. I touched on Luke Clanton and Blades Brown yesterday, but I'll throw out a few more for you today. Michael Brennan, Johnny Kiefer, two guys who have ascended the minor leagues at a rapid pace on the PGA Tour. Michael Brennan, of course, breaking through for his first tour victory last fall in Utah. A really good ham and egg pairing, too, when you combine Brennan's length, which statistically a top 10 wedge player that Johnny Kiefer is on the PGA Tour. Michael Thorbjornsson and Carl Phillips. Phillips, obviously an opposite field winner a year ago. Thor's been knocking on the door. Former Stanford teammates who probably know each other better than anybody. I remember when Phillips, still nursing a broken finger, caddied for Thor at the 2020 U.S. Amateur at Bandon Dunes. And then lastly, these guys are a little bit older, but Sam Stevens and Zach Bushu, two players who were a part of that vaunted 2018 Oklahoma State team that won it all at Carston Creek and have now put six players from that team on the PGA Tour. Sam Stevens already top 50 in the world, but still searching for his first win. And Bushu graduating off the Korn Ferry Tour a year ago. And I spent some time with him on Monday in Edmond, Oklahoma for a little special project that'll be debuting here in a few weeks. And I can just tell you, I can confirm the reports here when you talk to guys on the range who said they could be the sleepers this week. Their games looked awfully good at Oaktree National on Monday.
Brently Romine with all the news and nuggets on the teams at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. All right, folks, stick around. Much more ahead, including this recent major champ on the senior circuit. Stewie Cink will join us next, fresh off his senior PGA Championship victory.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Here's the menu for the senior majors this year on the PGA Tour Champions. We just had one, the Concession Golf Club in Bradenton, Florida, for the senior PGA Championship. The region's tradition, Greystone down in Birmingham, Alabama. Then only a couple of hours separate the U.S. Senior Open from the College Companies Championship, both of those in Ohio at Scioto and Firestone, respectively. And then the Senior British Open Championship being played at Glen Eagles in Scotland.
Look at that picture of Stewart Cink. Why is this man smiling? Well, last week was the first major in the 15-over set. And Senior PGA, as you mentioned, was that spicy concession. What a performance from Cink. Final round 63 on Sunday propelled him to a six-shot win over the field for his first ever senior major victory. They're rolling from everywhere, Eamon.
They certainly were. He was hot in that round yesterday. That had to be one of the better rounds he's played on a Sunday in his career on any tour.
Absolutely. And just able to enjoy a nice, easy walk up the 18th. And this is someone who's fully embraced senior tour golf. That heavy trophy must have felt light, though. Seven wins now on the 50 and over set, including that senior PGA. Three wins each of the last couple of seasons. Won the 2025 Charles Schwab Cup, both the race and the trophy, the tournament, and 32 top 10s in 41 career starts. How about this player? I mean, this is someone we've spoken to quite a bit, and we'll get to him in a little bit. I mean, he was kind of
The secret to the success. Talk to him, he wins again the following week.
But remember, he was kind of conflicted. Do I play on the PGA Tour? Do I split time? Now I feel like he's dedicated to the Champions Tour, and he's seeing the benefit.
Well, that's a commonality among guys who remained competitive deep into their 40s, way Stewart Cink did. So it wasn't that much of a surprise that he wanted to try to see how much he could be a hybrid between those two tours. But you do often see it when guys really do focus in on one tour and give that all of their focus. Then you start to see the results that he's putting up right now. You saw that he's on a kind of a Hill Irwin pace right now. You've got 32 top 10 finishes in 41 events. He's won seven times. This is the first senior major, but he'd been in contention in a lot of senior majors before getting this one. He's about to turn 53 years old next month. So he's kind of in that real sweet spot right now. Life is good for Stewart Cink on the PGA Tour Champions.
And we've seen this for guys in the early 50s when they come out hot. Padraig Harrington, Stephen Auker from nowhere. You mentioned Hill Irwin.
And they haven't gone away anywhere either. He's beating those guys.
But I want to know if Stewart will be a latter-day Hill Irwin or a Bernhard Lang or someone who will continue to push forward as he gets into his latter 50s and early 60s. Will he have the hunger, desire, the health to maybe chase wins in the mid-40s?
Well, he certainly had a pretty good career as far as injuries go. He's been fairly blessed in that sense. He seems very robust now. He definitely seems to have the hunger for the game right now. So, which, of course, winning breeds winning with these guys as well. Once the confidence is there, the skill set doesn't go anywhere. But when you've got the confidence of doing what Stuart Sink did on Sunday to blow away the field in what is the oldest of all the senior majors, that just kind of breeds more confidence, especially when you get into a tight schedule of senior majors. They do tend to come tightly packed together. So this may not be the only senior major we see him carrying away this year, because once you hit that confidence and the skills are working in your way at this time of the year, you can really capitalize out there.
I hope he wins a bunch of senior majors, because I always felt he never got his just due for winning that 2009 Open at Turnberry when he beat Tom Watson, who was by far the favorite in terms of that head-to-head. The world, the globe was rooting for the 59-year-old Tom Watson, and Stuart didn't get enough love.
He'll never play in front of a more kind of sedate, quiet crowd than he did that day. But, you know, it toughens him as a competitor for sure.
It does. And he seems to be at the height of power. Stuart Sink joins us now. Congratulations, man. Love that you're visiting us again. I got to ask you, your last five wins, by the way, playoff. Then you won by two shots, then by three, then by four, and now by six. How would you describe the control you feel you have over the golf ball?
Well, you know, you don't really want to poke that bear too much as a golfer. You guys know how that is. But I have the last 6 months or so, I've enjoyed feeling, you know, really confident with that control, like you said, control over the golf ball. Off the tee, you know, the golf course is really set up for me off the tee first. And if I put the ball in play, I've got enough power where I can make the golf courses fairly easy. And I've got a good game plan. And the rest of the game is just, it's fairly consistent. You know, you hit the driver the farthest and you have therefore the most variety of where the ball can end up. So if you keep that in play, then, you know, you set yourself up for some good scores and you're lowering your ceiling for high scores is important.
Stuart, in your first couple of years out there on the senior circuit, you'd racked up a lot of top three finishes in senior majors. You were in contention a lot. How much did it actually mean to you to get that senior major?
It actually meant a lot, you know, to win a tournament that has that much history and that has a full field. It does mean a lot. I'm not going to lie and say, you know, it means every bit as much as the major on the regular tour, like the Open in 2009 you were just talking about. But in senior golf, you know, there's several majors and the ones that matter the most. And that's, you know, the one you want to peak for. And I don't prepare for those any different than I prepare for any tournaments. But it was very sweet to be able to play well. And on that golf course, that's a tough track, and to be able to perform well and be disciplined and stick to my game plan and you know, execute the shots and come up with a low score, it was really satisfying.
Stuart, there are a few things in life that we're better in our 50s than we were in our 30s, maybe wine tasting. In what ways are you a better golfer in your 50s versus your 30s?
Well, I consider myself to be a student of golf, really. I have so much respect for the game and all the competitors, and I just enjoy the pursuit of being as good as I can be at golf every day. And, you know, I've learned a lot. And so part of improving is learning from the recent and the distant past, and the game emotionally and mentally, and to a certain extent physically, but really emotionally and mentally teaches you lessons along the way. And I think we have a word for that, and it's called experience. And if you choose to dive into that experience and really understand why, then, you know, you can step a few steps forward. And that's kind of been the thing for me. I feel like I'm just a little bit mentally more strong now than I've ever been. And part of that might be the venue, you know, playing PGA Tour Champions Golf. I mean, that's, I'm sure that has something to do with it. It's an odd thing to step out and be, you know, you're in your rookie season, you're at the best you're ever going to be in any league. It's not like the NBA or the NFL where it takes a little time to sort of get there. In the PGA Tour Champions, you're very best at the very first moment you turn 50 and then you start to decline.
Well, Bernhard Langer might choose to differ with you on that one, I guess, to an extent. This was a PGA of America major championship you won. You've expressed interest in perhaps being part of a conversation about a Ryder Cup captaincy in the future. Has that conversation gone anywhere? Or is that still something you're interested in?
Of course, I would love to captain a team for the U.S., but no, the conversation hasn't gone anywhere. There's been nothing, and so I think my time might have passed if there was a time for me. But I'll root for the USA and cheer them on from my couch, I guess. But they're an organization that that they're going to do their thing the way they always do it in their process, and not many people really know how that all happens. I don't personally, but I'm not a part of that this year, I guess. And so it'll be maybe another time, but every couple of years I get older, the captaincy seems to keep getting younger. And Keegan Bradley and Brant Snedeker are two, most recent examples of how much younger they're getting. And so I think time's probably not on my side, but no hard feelings here. I root for the USA and I love those team events. And I hope that we can turn the Ryder Cup ship around.
Well, do you think Sunday aided your case at all? You won a PGA of America event. There were PGA of America officials in your midst.
It might have aided his case to get on the team, much less actually captain the team at this point.
I don't know. I mean, those guys with the PGA and the gals, I know most of those guys, because I've been around them a lot of events and I've played in several PGAs, and that's actually my fourth senior PGA I've played in. So I'm getting a little older here, but I don't know if that has anything to do with it. They don't usually look at like on the course current form as a Ryder Cup captaincy, benchmark. So I wouldn't put a lot of store into that. It's nice to be around them and they run a great tournament, and I'm honored to have my name on that big trophy.
Well, you're controlling what you can control, including that golf ball. Congratulations on your first senior major and thanks for the time.
All right, you guys, thanks. Always good to visit with you now.
Stuart Sink, Golf Today, back after this. We're back on Golf Today. What a career. 22 years of age, the Stanford senior, Megha Ghane, putting together. Last year, she was T7 in the Augusta National Women's Amateur. Then she went on to win the U.S. Women's Amateur, beating Brooke Bierman 4-3 in the 36-hole final at beautiful Band in Dunes in Oregon. And the win earned Ghane an exemption into this week's Chevron Championship.
She is one of eight amateurs in the field this week as well. You see some of the familiar names there. Paula Martín San Pedro, Chiara Romero, the number one ranked amateur in the world. And Megha Ghane joins us now. Megha, it's always great to see you. This isn't your first major championship. I'm curious if you're getting more comfortable in this environment, and are you comfortable enough to think that you can actually be in contention come the weekend?
I think so. I like to think I go into every tournament thinking I can contend and maybe even win. So it's very nice to have multiple majors under my belt. Didn't think that was going to be something I get to say when I'm still a senior in college. But I've been blessed with a lot of professional starts and super excited for this week. I've never played a major other than the Women's Open, so the Chevron's really exciting.
Because of that, how open do you have to be to the fact that this still could be a learning experience, even if you want to compete and win?
Yeah, definitely. Every time I tee it up is a learning experience. I try to learn as much as I can in these practice rounds, and got to play with some of my teammates in the beginning of the week, and we got to play with Lydia Ko, and she practices out of Stanford sometimes, and she's always been my favorite player for a really long time, and there's still so much I learn from her every time I'm around her practicing or playing out here. So, definitely a lot of role models that I still have out here.
We talked to a couple of those role models earlier in the week, Megha. We had Amy Alcott on the show, Julie Inkster, Brittany Lincecum was just with us, and they all talked about how it's so rare for very young players coming out in the game these days who will really pick the brains of the veterans, that they seem to have a team around them from college. Where do you fit on that scale? Do you try to soak up the knowledge of those veterans, or are you also quite comfortable with the people you have assembled around you now?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a careful balance to strike. I do think there's value to, relying on the stuff that got you here and the team that you've built and I've been able to build over the last 18 months. And I feel very confident that the people around me and my routines and how I go about things is enough to put together a really good week. But that definitely doesn't mean that there's stuff that you can't learn from other players and people who have been here a lot longer than you. And I try to pick the brains of Stanford alums out on tour all the time, and yeah, I think there's always something to learn, but there is a good balance to strike between being open-minded, but also really grounded and confident in what your own capabilities.
From Stanford alums to a sibling at Harvard, your sister Serena gave a beautiful speech on your behalf when you were awarded the Met Golf Player of the Year. She was wonderful. Speak about your relationship and how close you two are. She seemed to really just paint you in a wonderful light.
Well, that's the first I would have heard of her painting me in a wonderful light. So I wish I was at this award ceremony. But I'm glad she did a good job. I'm super proud of her. Yeah, she's got, I think Harvard's playing in the Ivy League championships this week, so I'll be tuning into that. And yeah, I got another college golf team to root for now, so it's exciting. And my sister is wonderful, and I'm excited that she decided to walk onto a college golf team. So golf has infected my whole family now. Even my mom's picking it up, which is fun.
What does your competitive future look like, Megha? Seems as though you've got a fairly big decision looming at some point this year as to whether or not to move into the paid ranks and when that might happen.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my current plan is to finish out this college spring season, hopefully win another national title before I leave Stanford, graduate, and then have a professional debut at Riviera with the exemption I got from winning the USAM, and I can compete as a pro, which is really exciting.
Megha, always great to spend a few minutes with you. You're one of the bright lights in the game. Have a great week in Houston. Best of luck.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Craig Kesler, back in May of 2025, he was elected the 10th commissioner of the LPGA. And prior to the LPGA, Kesler served as chief operating officer of the PGA of America. And from the beginning, Kesler stated that the success of his tenure will be based on four pillars: building trust with players, increasing player visibility, building around fans, and creating a financial future. Golf Week senior writer Beth Ann Nichols had the chance to sit down with the commissioner early in March. Here is that interview.
As one does.
Right. Thanks for coming.
Good to be here.
Well, thanks for having us here at your home club, Trinity Forest.
Thank you. It's a special place. Means a lot to our family.
For people who are just getting to know you, how did you get your start in this game?
It started as a young kid growing up in San Diego, California. Used to go play Rancho Carlsbad. We called it the cow pasture. There wasn't a blade of grass on the golf course.
The dream childhood, it sounds like.
It was awesome.
You're the 10th commissioner of the LPGA. What made you say yes to this job?
I think every now and again in life, somebody may get the opportunity to do something that can actually make a difference in the world. And as corny as it may sound, I feel it. And this is one of those opportunities.
What do you find collectively? I realize there are a lot of opinions on a tour of this size, but collectively, what do you think they think should be your first priority right now at this point?
For some, it means help us get access to the best courses in the world. For some, it's about purses. For others, it's about playing opportunities. The common thread across all those examples is, Craig, please do your part to help elevate the tour.
Gino Titicoon goes back-to-back at the CME Group Tour Championship.
She's done it.
Gino Titicoon wins again.
You recently got back from your second trip to Asia. Now you've seen the Gino hoopla, right? Everyone was going crazy for her. It was fabulous.
It's a dream come true for Gino, a win on home soil.
How do you get that kind of energy domestically?
One of the reasons Thailand was off the charts is because you have Gino, a Thai hero, playing in front of her home crowd. 15,000 fans a day, every day, to watch what Gino does. The Thai fans know about Gino. They know what she does in the offseason in her hometown, helping impoverished communities rise up and become optimistic about the future. Those are the types of things we have to do here too. And when we go to a player's hometown, tell the story about that player and get fans from that player's high school or university to come out. And over time, the energy starts to build. It doesn't happen in one season, but I'm really confident we'll get there.
So you were asked about a major in Asia at the CME as well, and you said you were open to it. Now, you've been to Asia several times now. You've had a lot of conversations. Is that a real potential?
Yes, we're very open to it. As a challenger brand, we're going to take risk. We're going to try new things. Some will work and we'll lean into those. Some won't. We may have to say we're sorry occasionally along the way, but I really hope our fans understand when we take risk and try new things, it's all in the spirit of elevating the tour and inspiring our fans.
The Hilton Grand Tournament had a little bit of controversy.
It's been a chaotic morning out here at Lake Nona Golf and Country Club. Certainly does not feel like we are in Central Florida with temperatures dipping into the low 20s here overnight. After a series of delays in which play was pushed back several times, the LPGA has now reached the decision that they are going to reduce the season opening event to just 54 holes.
Nelly was declared the winner despite not hitting a shot on Sunday. With that final round cancelled, her third round, 64, was good enough for that victory.
Obviously shortened to 54 holes, didn't go into the Monday finish. A lot was made about the fact that celebrities played and the LPGA players didn't on Sunday. What did you learn from that experience?
How much time do you have? A lot. I didn't sleep a full night for 2 weeks, you know, looking at the ceiling at 2 o'clock in the morning, sick to my stomach, talking to my wife and kids about it, apologizing to our team in tears, thinking, man, if I lost trust this early on with people I care about, those are things that as a leader hit you hard. The fundamental lesson learned is about preparation. The lessons learned from the Tournament of Champions have caused us to go back and make sure we're buttoned up, our processes are airtight, and if we're ever in a situation like this again, we're better prepared than ever before.
The LPGA staged its first tournament backed by the PIF with the new Aramco Championship in Vegas, and obviously there's been a lot of controversy in golf about Saudi-backed events. How deep do you see this relationship going between the PIF and the LPGA?
I think it is my job and our job at the LPGA to do our part to unite the women's professional golf world. The Ladies European Tour has been supported by Golf Saudi to the tune of probably north of $100 million over the last 4 or 5 years. Who are we to tell an organization they can't fund the hopes and dreams of many of our athletes? Yeah.
Congratulations to Charlie Hull, PIF Saudi Ladies International winner.
To those who are concerned about a women's organization partnering with a government that does have a history of women's abuses, how would you respond to that? What do you tell them?
Before we entered into the partnership with the LET and Golf Saudi for the Aramco Championship, we talked to our players. We asked, are you comfortable? And the overwhelming response was positive. And they said, you know what? Your job is to elevate the tour. They've come in and offered a $4 million purse at one of the best courses in the world. Let's go. So I do believe there's the potential to do more.
So the WTGL, if successful, should bring a lot of new fans to the game.
That's right.
What are the things that have to fall in place for that to happen, you think?
Players will play on Monday and Tuesday nights when they're not ordinarily on TV. They're going to be mic'd up the entire time, and it'll give fans a chance to experience our players' personalities. I hope there's some smack talk. TGL, we know, is attracting younger audiences and demographics than what's typically picked up on the broadcast, and that represents huge opportunity for us.
How do you measure success at the end of your first year?
There are some quantifiable metrics, viewership, financial stability of the organization. How are we doing with our social content engine, and is it engaging and are fans plugging in the ways we want? Then there are the intangibles that are hard to describe, but you know it when you feel it. Are players pumped up? When I'm in player dining, are they coming up and sharing their ideas and excited about where we're going, or do they put their head down and walk the other way? Are sponsors continuing to show up with their time and their resources? Are courses welcoming us to play? Mm. All of those things matter. And I'll tell you, I don't know, 8-9 months into the job now, I'm very proud of the direction we're heading.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
And Beth Ann Nichols from Golf Week magazine joins us now from the Chevron. Wonderful sit-down interview with Craig Kesler. I was struck by his description of Thailand and how the fans really embraced Geno and wanting to see the same thing happen in the United States. Is that incumbent upon American fans? Is it incumbent upon American players? How did you take that conversation from the commissioner?
I definitely think that the onus is on the LPGA to to do a number of things. I think the commissioner is doing an admirable job of getting players to say yes more. We've seen that happen right from the beginning of this year from some top players. I still don't think the players understand quite the breadth of how much they need to be saying yes. This is an entertainment, a business after all. And so I think that the more he can get players to buy into the things that the tour needs them to do, the easier it's going to be for fans to know their names. So, unfortunately, winning inside the ropes isn't enough these days for LPGA players to be known stateside. There's just way too much competition for everyone's attention.
Bethan, Craig said he was open to the idea of a major championship being played in Asia, where there's obviously a tremendous market for women's golf, a lot of independent tours operating over there. Would that mean we go to six, or is the potential for losing one of the existing five?
Potentially neither of those options. I think maybe there might be some conversations about getting an existing major to perhaps move around and have, some events overseas and be in a rotation sometimes in the U.S. and sometimes abroad. I see that maybe as a first step in trying to convince one of the existing partners to take the show on the road. I don't think six is ever going to be a possibility. I actually welcome it when the conversation about adding the players for a fifth major for the men's game comes around, because I feel like it put the women's game on equal footing there. But I would be surprised if we saw, a major bow out at this point.
Well, Craig did say he's willing to take risks and everything that goes with that. Were you struck by how emotional he was when he talked about the early days of his commissionership and everything that went wrong in Orlando in terms of the weather-shortened event for the pros versus the celebrities, and how he stared at the ceiling for 2 weeks in a row and had tears in his eyes?
Yeah, it definitely struck me for sure. I mean, I think, number one, it shows you how passionate he is about this job. I think that's really genuine. I also think it shows that, he's not going to just brush that under the rug. He really wants to make sure that something like that doesn't happen again and put the things in place that need to be to ensure that. And unfortunately, I would say the TOC, was probably the mark of the end of the honeymoon period. And then, I think when we saw what happened with Lydia and the 59 watch, I took them to task on Twitter, the fact that the tour really did nothing to promote that. I think, unfortunately, there are going to be several instances along the way where he's going to see, unfortunately, in real time, the pain points that maybe he didn't know existed prior and the foundation work that needs to be done. It's not just the big picture things that we're looking at in terms of money coming in from FM and other places, which is certainly a big win. But there are some structural things the LPGA really needs to look at. And I think, these things are just bound to happen. It's how he reacts to them and how he corrects them moving forward that's the ultimate test.
On that subject of money coming in, Bethan, you did ask Craig about Saudi money on the LPGA Tour through this avenue of the ladies' European tour. His response was interesting. He said, "Who are we to tell an organization that they can't fund the hopes and dreams of our athletes?" Does that sound like a bit of a trite platitude when the agency in question is giving the money that's an agency of a government that suppresses the rights of women? Shouldn't they actually have a few more concerns than that?
Well, I think the reality is he's saying what the players are saying, and the players don't have an issue with it. And so, as the person hired to represent them and create opportunities for them, he's simply doing, the mission, I guess you could say, of what his players want. And so in that regard, even though there are a lot of folks who think otherwise, you can understand why he would go down that road and try to see, exactly how far he can take it. And let's be honest, we had the Aramco not very long ago, and there really wasn't a lot of backlash. There really wasn't a lot of chatter, about it, domestically. So, and we see how much they're involved with women's tennis, and we really don't hear a whole lot of backlash. There was initially, but we don't hear much about that you know, these days. So it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. A lot of uncertainty in that realm.
Speaking of oil and gas, big Chevron signs right behind you in this first edition of the Chevron at Memorial Park. Does it feel like it has the potential, Beth Ann, to be a long-term home for the first major of the year?
Well, they're certainly willing to invest to make it so, you know, especially when you look at what they're going to do for starting next year with the 18th and building a permanent pond for to carry on the tradition of the Champions Leap. So when you're willing to make such a big change like that and redo the green, call the architect back in to redo the 18th, I think that definitely shows a strong commitment from, you know, the golf course and Chevron. So it's still early days to see how this is going to play out in terms of, you know, will the crowd come? I'd like to see more cross promotion going forward between the PGA Tour event and the LPGA so that when, you know, fans are coming out here to watch the men, that they know that this is coming. So hopefully we see more stuff like that, you know, down the road, that these are still early days. As I said earlier in the week, all this came together rather quickly. So, but there are just some, you know, obvious things that I think they could do, you know, going forward to try to make this a home run.
And it all begins tomorrow, 11 a.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. Beth Ann, have a great week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's take you back to the 2024 Zurich Classic of New Orleans, making their debut as teammates at the Zurich Classic. Longtime friends Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry defeated Chad Ramey and Martin Traynor on the first playoff hole. Got a couple of heavyweight belts for the victory as well.
Yeah. This year, though, Rory out, Brooks in. Let's take a look at their season so far. You see Brooks 4, top 25s and 7 starts. Best finish, T9 at the Cognizant. Shane Lowry, couple top 10s and 8 starts. Best finish, that co-runner-up in the Palm Beaches. And Brooks and Shane join us now. Great to see you both, Shane. So when you found out that Rory wasn't playing, what's the process of choosing a teammate? Do you just scroll through the phone and get to the K's and say, Brooks sounds good to me? What was the process like?
Yeah, no, I asked about 10 or 12 other guys first. And they all said no. Rory quickly said after last year, I don't think he wanted to come back. So it wasn't until the end of the year I was doing my schedule and, you know, I was going to add this in. I knew I needed to start looking for a new teammate, and I met Brooks down in Florida at a place where we both practice just after Christmas, and mentioned that I might need a partner for New Orleans. So he said he'd be up for it, and kind of went from there. I said it to his caddy Ricky a couple of weeks later, and then I saw Brooks a few weeks after that and said, are we going to tee it up together? And he said yes. So nice to be here. You have to have multiple majors to be able to team up with me in this tournament. So it's good that you said yes.
Brooks, what's the trickiest part of playing as a team? What are you guys figuring out in a practice round that people at home wouldn't necessarily think of?
I think just trying to figure out what holes Shane's comfortable with hitting tee balls off of, which ones I'm comfortable with. It's just looking at kind of how guys feel. He might be a little more comfortable hitting irons in a certain hole. So, I mean, I'd love for him to play all the par threes the way he's playing this year on par threes. But, yeah, we're just going out there just getting a feel for things, and I think that's important and trying to build off each other. He's been playing phenomenal this year, so he's been putting himself in contention. And I'm just trying to stay out of the way and let him do his thing.
Shane, if you guys do win on Sunday, who takes the lead in singing? Because you weren't belting out much of a tune whenever you won with Rory. He seemed to be doing all the work that day.
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest. I'll happy right now, if you were to give me to say I was going to win, I'm happy singing. But I might have to have one or two more than I did before that performance from Rory.
Brooks, as someone who's looking to get into as many events as possible and get into that signature event rotation, how quick was the yes when Shane started talking to you about playing in New Orleans?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny enough, I remember it. He was actually sitting at a table with Rory when he asked me. So, I think it was either December or January. I forget what it was. It was around that time. And I think at the time when he asked me, I wasn't sure what my playing schedule was going to be. So, yeah, look, I'm just happy to be here and happy to be a part of it. And I'm thankful to have a good partner, and we'll see how the week goes.
Shane, you grew up in you play an individual sport, but you very much grew up in a team environment at home. Why does team sports kind of tick your box for you so easily?
I think it's just, to be honest, it's just more fun. I think, you know, the week-to-week grind on the PGA Tour, look, we're very blessed and very lucky to have the job that we have, you know, been out here doing the thing that you love for a living. But, you know, the week-to-week grind can get a little bit monotonous at times. And I think, you know, when you get something different and you get a team event and you're able to go out there with your teammates and, you know, even, you know, Brooks's caddy, Ricky, is, you know, a breath of fresh air out there for me as well.
For you.
Yeah. For me. And, you know, I think, yeah, you just get, it's just more fun. Honestly, it really is. And, you know, you get to enjoy the good things, you know, together, but you also get to, you know, the tough times out there, you get to have someone to lean on as well, which is always nice.
Yeah, I mean, not to cut you guys off here, but I think it's interesting because, yeah, I see a different side of them too when we're playing this event, just even thus far and even in the practice rounds, and it's quite interesting. I'm not in those team rooms on the Ryder Cup or on Europe side, but it's I could see why he plays so well in the in a team format. It makes complete sense once you're out there. He enjoys it. He thrives off it. He kind of, once, if I hit a good shot, he's got a little more pep in his step, and then all of a sudden it just snowballs into something good. And you can even see it. I mean, we haven't even got the juices flowing, but I mean, just in a little bit of a pro-am, you could tell the difference.
Shane, you guys are obviously buddies. You live in South Florida together, but would this been a difficult call to make if this was a Ryder Cup year and we were a few months away from the Ryder Cup versus more than a year plus away?
No, well, I think our plan is probably to win and we'll come back and defend next year. You know, and that's a Ryder Cup year. But to be honest, I never even thought about it. Like, it's... you know, I've obviously competed against Brooks in the Ryder Cup, but yeah, this is just different.
Brooks, do you think...
I'm just looking for FedEx Cup points.
And you're not necessarily guaranteed to be on the Ryder Cup team next year either. Do you think the PGA Tour needs
well
a little...
Pointed.
Does the PGA Tour need a little bit more of this, Brooks, in terms of changing up the format once in a while, make something a little bit more fun? Or are you good with kind of 1 week a year as just a little bit of a different taste?
I don't think I'm in a good position to call shots out here. I'll put it that way. I think just coming back, I'm just happy to be out here, excited. But I don't think I should be calling shots on what we're doing, considering I'm only 4 months back into this. But I do enjoy this event. I think it's fun. I've played it in years past when I was a part of the tour before, and it's fun. You know, I got to play with my brother. I got to play with Mark Trinessa. It was a blast. I enjoy the week. It's a different vibe completely, even from me and Ricky to me and Shane. It's fun. Like you said, you've got somebody out there you can enjoy the good times with and kind of turn around and say sorry to a few times before get tired of hearing it. But it's enjoyable. And I used to enjoy the match play as well. I thought that was a really fun event. We were actually talking about it out there earlier today. It's something I enjoyed, and it's something different.
Brooks, just following up on your schedule, the next 2 weeks leading into the PGA Championship are both signature events that you're not yet in. Will you take time at home those 2 weeks, or will you play the opposite field event in Myrtle Beach to try to get ready for the PGA?
I think I could probably answer that question, but after, yeah, at the end of this week, I'll know a lot more. I'm hoping to be in those. That would be great if I can play well, or if we can play well enough and be in those. But I gotta play as much as I can. So we'll see what the schedule brings. But hopefully, after a good week this week, everything will settle itself out.
Shane, Brooks talked about your great par three play. I know what happens at country clubs. There's like a hole in one fun, and you make an ace, and maybe you buy drinks at the bar. Like, what happens when you make aces during the Masters? You get some crystal, but do you got to buy drinks for the field? Like, what happens when you make an ace at the Masters?
Yeah, you're two more under going to the next tee. I actually didn't. You know, it's funny, the hole in one at Houston was on the Sunday, so everyone had left when we finished. And then at the Masters, I actually didn't. Everything's free in that new player services building. So I told everyone to help themselves to that free bar.
Well, hopefully you guys have a reason to head to the bar this weekend and maybe belt out a song or two for us. Thanks for the time, guys, and good luck this week.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Damon.
Interesting week for LIV Golf. From imminent breaking news last week that the PIF was planning to pull funding, to LIV CEO Scott O'Neill ensuring the league is funded through the end of the year, the week in Mexico City culminated with a Jon Rahm victory. Brody Miller, staff writer for The Athletic, was sent to Mexico City last week to learn more about the rapidly developing and some might say deteriorating situation. Brody, nice to see you in New Orleans. Last week, you and your colleagues break this story about the Saudis deciding to pull funding from LIV Golf. How would you describe the surreal events that followed, including some security issues that you faced?
Yes, it's been a wild week for everyone in golf, especially over there at LIV. And yes, I flew down Wednesday night on a last second flight to Mexico City to try to just figure out what was going on with LIV Golf and kind of what was real and what wasn't. Obviously, I think LIV Communications were not replying to any of us in those first few days because they were trying to figure everything out themselves, I believe. So they didn't get back. I went the first day as just a spectator, observing, watching, and they got back to me Friday, immediately gave me a credential. But I was stopped by a security officer who told me that the day before there was a security alert sent out on me, and that all ended up getting ironed out, but definitely adds to a bit of the chaos surrounding LIV Golf right now.
What was the sense you left that week in Mexico City with Brody? Is there just a sense of complete uncertainty and a little bit of paranoia about what the future of the league actually holds at this point?
Uncertainty, definitely. You cannot ignore that. The strangest part, though, was there. I did come away with whether it's projected or not, a very strong belief within LIV that things are going to get figured out. A really strong sense from people from Scott O'Neill's team down to general managers and players. There is this strange confidence coming, I believe, that they think that they can sell these team evaluations for good money equity, that they can raise money from other private equity funds. And that is not for me to say whether that is realistic or not, but there definitely is a strange kind of us against the world assurance mixed with, uncertainty. I think nobody knows what's actually going to happen. Nobody. And I think the part that can't be ignored is the suddenness of this for LIV. Yes, I think whether or not PIF had been trying to change his strategy for a few months, that's definitely something that's been happening for a while. But the sudden shift from Masters Week, kind of optimism, Scott O'Neill and constant meetings, to all of a sudden Sunday it being, hey, LIV might not get through Mexico City, I think that has left a lot of them rattled and scrambling.
I know it's hard to remove your reporter's hat, but as a sports fan, what was it like on the ground? Were you entertained? Were the people enjoying themselves? What was the scene actually like?
Yeah, that's the hard, because I think, I'll admit, you go there thinking it's going to be disarray, right? You go there thinking it's going to be a league, everyone just kind of running around like chickens with their heads cut off. But in reality, I think it was just a normal golf tournament. I mean, it was a LIV golf tournament, so maybe not normal. But yeah, I think, there were really good crowds in Mexico City, Thursday to Sunday. The players all still were really engaging with the fans, high-fiving everybody. You know, it's hard to, I think there was a very clear uncertainty. Players are whispering, players are chatting, everybody's trying to figure out what's going on. Obviously, the optics of the Thursday stream going out right after Arlo White and David Faraday criticized all of us reporters was probably a very bad look. But all in all, it was just kind of normal, which is what made this kind of, there was a strange cognitive dissonance there.
And Bryson DeChambeau didn't actually make it as far as the final round in Mexico, Brody, withdrawing with an injury beforehand. You reported in The Athletic last week that Bryson and his team had met with potential alternative sources of employment for him during the week of the Masters. Is it fair to say that you think he is the big contract that's up this year, but you'd assume a lot of those players, with all the uncertainty, must at least be thinking about what their options may be if the worst happens?
I think that's a really healthy way to put it, that they're at the very least looking at their options. Bryson's always tough, right? As well as I, that Bryson is always going to be shopping for the best deal, always finding the best leverage and best opportunity. As far back as the U.S. Open last year last U.S. Open, why am I, my brain going absent? At Oakmont, he was talking about how he, will be negotiating with LIV and trying to find the best deal for everybody. And that's the Masters Week. He was meeting with different executives, different brands, different leagues about what a path might look back. And the tricky thing is, Liv has said, and Liv sources confirm, that they are not going back down the path of hundreds of millions of dollars to keep these players. They can't afford it, and they just realize it's bad business. But if you can't do that, what keeps somebody at Liv? Bryson DeChambeau has been a very vocal supporter of Liv. He's somebody who really openly says that, you know, this is something he believes in. But it's easier to do that when you're getting $100 million plus reportedly. And when he's asking for as much as $500 million, according to our sources, I just really am curious what happens there when Liv doesn't meet that number. Support is one thing, but do you keep that going when the paychecks aren't coming?
So what is the path forward for Liv Golf without the support of the Saudi Public Investment Fund? What is Scott O'Neill's path forward?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing that really no one would shed light on, including Scott O'Neill on my trip there, was he keeps alluding to possible paths. He keeps saying there's multiple paths we could go, might be something with the National Opens, you know, might be other things. And I think, one, a lot of questions remain of what does that mean? What does that look like? The DP World Tour runs most of the important National Opens, so I don't know what's on the table for that. But in terms of the short term, I don't think there's any denying that number one is, and he said it, even though he criticized a lot of the reporting, that he needs to raise money and he needs to do it fast. There's no denying that. I think something that they are, again, whether you believe it or not, very optimistic in is that they can sell equity in these 13 teams. They put the valuation close to $300 million. Whether or not that's true, I am not a business expert, but they think they can get a strong amount of equity from that. They say they have meetings this week with investors that are interested and reached out to them. And they also believe that they can probably get other outside funding. And they're also not removing the possibility that maybe relationship with PIF continues, but as for now, that deal is over.
Just adding to all of this uncertainty, Brody, it's one thing to say that, you know, you've got investment interest out there, there are other potential sources of funding, but if you're one of the vendors, presumably you're going to be pretty skittish right now. I mean, Liv had been trying to buy some of the National Opens, as you mentioned, at the DP World Tour run. If you're one of those National Golf Associations, you're probably thinking, is that really a safe bet that you'd want to make right now? Does the public investment fund or funding actually carry you forward with that kind of arrangement? The same with other vendors they have relationships with. I think we've actually maybe lost Brody right now. I believe we have. But this is an interesting question here, Damon, in terms of where they go forward. You have vendors right. Who have commitments to Liv, whether it's in terms of the venues, for example, that they're in, or it's just simply the infrastructure vendors that are attached to tournaments. They've got to be wondering, do they need to get paid up front at this point?
Yeah.
Because last week was a very bad look in the sense of Scott O'Neill going from the week before saying we are fully funded through 2032. I think we have Brody back in here. Now, Brody, last week, Scott O'Neill had been saying at the Masters they were fully funded through 2032. I guess my question is, if you're a vendor, are you going to start looking for upfront payments at this point? Because it's a long way to go from saying you're funded through 2032 to basically saying that you're funded through August when the season officially ends.
I think that is the key question that is probably hard to pin down right now, but the most important, that as much as you can project confidence, as much as you can say we have sponsors coming, all these things, what does that look like when the entire world is talking about your potential demise? What does that mean when you don't know if Bryson's coming back or what the future of this league looks like? Do those sponsors that are invested, that are intrigued, that want to be part of these teams, is that going to continue? I think the quick answer is we don't know yet, but I think that is the number one thing to follow. And I think a lot of the reporting that needs to happen in the coming weeks is trying to understand how intrigued are these sponsors? How intrigued are the investors if that's uncertain? Because, yeah, it's one thing when you have the confidence of saying you have a company funding you for the foreseeable future, that their own chairperson says we measure success of investments in decades, not years. And now you are a company that has to project confidence by quarter, that has to show a direct path to profit in a business plan. I think you will see cut costs. I think that's clear. I don't think they can get away with still spending $100 million a year. They're not going to pay these outrageous fees anymore. But is that enough to keep them afloat and keep income coming in? I just don't know.
Brody, fantastic reporting by you and your team at The Athletic. Stay safe out there, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Take care.